Hello, everyone. This is the Oregon Conservative, broadcasting to you live from the great state of Oregon. Now, as I record this, it is Sunday, April 24th. When you hear this, it will most likely be the 25th and the 26th. So I say, hope you have a good day, night, evening, wherever you are listening to this podcast. I also like to say thank you for supporting the show by taking a listen. I would really appreciate it if you were to like this podcast and give it a 5-star review. And let your friends know, share a link. And if you really feel like supporting the show, you can go ahead and head to my website and you can go ahead and support the show that way. I'd also love for you to head over to the website to join my email newsletter, where we will be at the end of the month discussing issues and topics I did not discuss on the show. Over the weekend, I had the distinct privilege and honor of attending the Dorchester Conference. Now, as those of you who may not be in the loop know, Dorchester is the conference where a lot of Republican leaders come to, not only to network and social, but that's where we get an insight on issues. For example, we had Stephen Yates speak, who was the former deputy national security advisor to Dick Cheney speak. We had Congressman Cliff Benz speak as well. So it is a conference who I will recommend to any Republicans, especially newcomers to the state of Oregon like I am. It is well worth your time and well worth your energy to go and interact with candidates, interact with PCPs, to interact with the board, to interact with staff members. And it is something that I will continue to not only attend, but in the future support as well. So during my weekend trip to the Dorchester Conference, we were treated to a series of debates, and these debates you will be hearing throughout the week that I will post are captured live from Dorchester. And this debate today, as you probably already know, was also recorded live Friday evening. Friday evening was a debate between two Republican candidates for Oregon's 5th Congressional District. Now, to give you a little bit of background on Oregon's 5th Congressional District, it represents Oregon's central coast through Salem, north to the southern Portland suburbs, and east to the summit of Mount Hood. It includes Lincoln, Marion, and Polk counties, most of Clackamas and Tillamook counties, plus parts of Benton and Multnomah County. So we were treated to a debate for Kurt Schrader's seat, which is always a good thing to get Kurt Schrader, Democrat, out of office. Now, the two candidates who were at this debate were Jimmy Crumpacker and Lori Chavez DeRemer. Now, I didn't get the introductions on the recording, so I will do my best post to introduce them to the best of my abilities. Jimmy Crumpacker is a 7th-generation Oregonian whose family roots go back to 1850. Born and raised in Portland, Jimmy is a proud product of Oregon public schools. Jimmy went to Georgetown University, where he received his bachelor's in government. A longtime Republican, Jimmy attended college at Georgetown University, where he interned for former Senator Gordon Smith. After graduation, Jimmy began his career in the private sector, working for some of the largest companies in the country. Starting at American Insurance Group, Jimmy specialized in risk before joining First New York Securities as an investor in energy. After a successful career on Wall Street, Jimmy then moved home to Oregon and opened his own company. For the past 9 years, Jimmy and his company, Crumpacker Asset Management, have been investing in and securing American energy independence and augmenting the historic growth of the American energy sector. Having experienced tremendous private sector success, Jimmy began using his business skills to help local nonprofits. In 2014, Jimmy joined the board of the Oregon Ballet Theater at a time when the company was on the brink of financial ruin. OBT now has 50% of its budget in cash in the bank, eliminated its debt burden, and now has a budget 60% larger than when Jimmy joined the board after enjoying record-setting ticket sales. Jimmy also joined the board of Meals on Wheels, an organization with which he has been involved from the time he began delivering meals as a child with his grandmother. After his time as chair of the marketing and development committees, Jimmy had enjoyed driving the same weekly route delivering meals for the past 6 years. Jimmy has always felt a strong calling to public service and is proud to continue his family's legacy of serving Oregon. As a representative for Oregon's 5th Congressional District, Jimmy will be a fierce advocate for conservative, free market principles and for all Oregon. Oregon is ablaze right now thanks to politicians' disastrous policies coming from Washington, D.C. Inflation is running rampant thanks to out-of-control spending, driving up costs, and taking money right out of the pockets of hardworking Oregonians. Our cities are experiencing record crime, making it impossible to feel safe in your own home. Our forests are on fire thanks to bureaucratic incompetence and mismanagement. Jimmy will bring his private sector experience to these most pressing issues and rein in wasteful spending, restore law and order, and bring an end to the bureaucratic state. Jimmy is a conservative Republican and was proud to be endorsed by both Oregon Firearms Federation and Oregon Right to Life in 2020. As a political outsider and strong advocate of free market pro-growth principles, Jimmy will bring his proven business and private sector skills to Washington to help continue growing our economy, creating good-paying jobs for rural Oregonians, and to cut the size and scope of government. As an avid outdoorsman, Jimmy is committed to ensuring our national forests are properly managed and remain the pride of our district for generations to come. Jimmy knows this means decreasing federal ownership of our land and eliminating bureaucratic restraints that currently block access to our abundant resources. Jimmy lives in Tumalo, Oregon, on a farm his family has owned for the last 45 years. Now let's move on to his opponent in the primary, Lori Chavez de Remer. Honest, accomplished, and committed, Lori Chavez de Remer was a mayor of Happy Valley from 2010 to 2018, where she led Oregon's fastest growing community. As mayor, Lori presided over important changes in the city, making it more business friendly, offer more affordable housing options for family, and a safe place to build a career and raise a family. Her most important job, she'll tell you, is a mom and a small businesswoman. She's married to her high school sweetheart, Dr. Sean de Remer, and supported the couple as he finished medical school. Later, she helped Sean found Anesthesia Associates Northwest, and they now run several medical clinics throughout the Pacific Northwest. Lori's public service career began in 2002, serving on the Happy Valley Parks Committee, where she helped build the Happy Valley 4th of July Festival that it is today. Later, she won a seat on the Happy Valley City Council and became City Council President. She was elected mayor in 2010, becoming Happy Valley's first female and Latina elected mayor. She was re-elected in 2014. Lori and Sean are now parents of twin daughters who are making their own footprints in the world. Annie works in the family healthcare business on the management side, while Emily is a public defender in Michigan. And this debate was moderated by the Honorable Kevin Mannix. Kevin Mannix has been an attorney since 1974. During his first 8 years of service, he served as a law clerk to the Oregon Court of Appeals, as an assistant attorney general for Oregon, as an assistant attorney general for the U.S. territory of Guam, and as an administrative law judge for Oregon. Since 1986, he has run his own Salem law firm representing individuals, nonprofits, and businesses. Not only that, but he was state representative and a state senator. He was also the chair of the Oregon Republican Party, and he was the 2002 Republican candidate for governor. It put that into perspective. So without further ado, captured live from Dorchester Friday, our congressional district debate.
Oil in the world. We have the largest natural gas resources. We should be building Jordan Cove down in Coos Bay. That seems like a no-brainer to me. Because right now, our friends abroad could use the help. You know, we're paying $5 a BCF In Asia and Europe, they're paying $30. That seems like a great arb, right? Perhaps a very good business deal for all of our oil companies. For me, being energy independent means we no longer have to rely on foreign countries, and we can stake out where we want to go with our foreign policy, and that is critical.
All right, thank you. Molly, your turn.
We were energy independent just 18 months ago when President Trump was in office. Within 18 months, we have been reliant on every other country in this nation. The America First policies is where we need to focus our time. If we're going to be reliant on Vladimir Putin, and we're going to be reliant on every other country for our oil, how can we focus on America? What we know is that if we don't build the Keystone Pipeline, which was stopped, and it can be built in a matter of time, we'll have America's jobs. We can open up back Anwar, go to the million acres there to start drilling again. We can give out more licenses to our drilling companies with our royalty tax, which our now current president administration wants to administer. It will not only tank inflation more than we have now, our food shortages will continue, our gas prices will go up. We're paying about $4.70 on average in the state of Oregon. It costs a lot of money. Not only does that affect climate change under the guise of climate change, right? This is the argument that we keep listening to. And what we know is that the drilling is still going to happen in these foreign lands. We can do it cleaner, better in America. And we need to bring back our energy independence and be the superpower of the world again. And we can do that if we stay focused and bring back America First policies.
National debt. What is your perception of our situation in regard to the national debt, and what should Congress be doing to address this?
Stop spending. That would be something that we all recognize. We're living outside of our means. We can't do that in our own households. We're doing it in our state, and we're doing it in our country. We have over $30 trillion in debt. I don't even have grandkids yet. They're going to be paying the price for a very long time if we don't stop spending. So when we talk about what's important, why can't we be reliant on America First policies once again and keep not only building America First, but investing those dollars right back into our country. Our current congressional district, or excuse me, our current Congress, our president, they want to spend us, you know, I think about as a mayor, what any time that my constituents came before us and said, you know what, I want to open a business, I want to put in my hard-earned dollars, I want to be able to go to school and not pay off massive amounts of debts, I would like to own a home. We are putting them in the poorhouse. 8% inflation, the worst in 40 years under this administration. We have to get back to stop spending. We cannot have our supply chain, which was compounded after COVID, and then the trillions of dollars of spending come back in and think that we were going to get out of this easily. We're going to pay a hefty price to our future, and we have to stop spending now. And that's what I will do in Congress.
Thank you, Lori. Jimmy?
Yeah, unfortunately, this to me is a national security issue. The United States has gone, literally, when Kurt Schrader was elected in 2008, we had $8 trillion worth of debt. That number now is $30 trillion. So when interest rates go up, unfortunately, we're going to be paying trillions of dollars. And who owns our debt? That's what you need to ask. The Chinese have a huge portion of our debt. So think about that. If the Chinese want to punish us, they start selling that debt. All of a sudden, interest rates spike. That hurts the economy, and that really hurts the Treasury. Because the Treasury can't afford to pay off debt if interest rates are 4 or 5%. And we haven't been at 4 or 5% since 2007. But if you know that with inflation at 8.5%, the best way that the Fed can fight that is by raising interest rates. So therefore, that debt that we have, the $30 trillion, is going to make it almost impossible for us to pay back. This is a national security issue. We need to get this under control. Unfortunately, both Republicans and Democrats are responsible for this issue. We need to stop spending so much money. Because at this point, with With the debt currently at 125% of our economy, that is unsustainable. And if we keep spending like this, you know, the Biden bill last year, $1.9 trillion just added straight to the debt. That has to stop right now. We need Republicans to take back Congress so that we can actually get control of these budgets. Because if we can't control our spending, we are in real trouble. And it's something that is very concerning to me. So, thank you.
All right, thank you, Jimmy. Jimmy, you get the first round on this one, and this has to do with Medicaid and Medicare. It ties in probably with the affordability issue, but what sort of reforms would you want to see to the Medicare system, which is for all the seniors out there, and the Medicaid system, which is for people with low income?
Yeah, this is a very concerning issue. If anyone wants to go to sleep tonight, just read the Medicare trustees report. I've read it, it's 270 pages, it is dry as all get out. But what they say is that we are actually gonna run out of money in the Medicare trust fund by 2026. That's in 4 years, think about that. We ran a $60 billion deficit in our Medicare fund just last year. When seniors got this benefit originally, in 1970 it was a 12th of what they received from the federal government. Now it is half of what they get from the federal government. This is unsustainable. We need to get this program under control. When Lyndon Johnson signed it when he signed the bill to start the program, it was a $10 billion program. Last year, $962 billion. I mean, are you kidding? I mean, this is why investing in real estate in Washington, D.C. is the best investment you can make, right? The federal government just grows and grows and grows, and is unsustainable. And unfortunately, we can no longer kick the can down the road. With 2026, that is one election cycle away. And we need to change how it's operating. Unfortunately, it doesn't appear as though the Biden administration has the backbone to take it on. We need people with common sense in Congress to work out a plan to take it on, because I'm very worried. And unfortunately, the numbers say that everyone should be worried.
Thank you, Jimmy. Laurie.
This administration does have the backbone to take it on. They want to take on single-payer health care. Is that what we want in America? I'm telling you, if we don't become more patient-centric, we are in the healthcare industry. If you notice, in Oregon, our premiums have doubled. Our insurers have gone from 10 to 5. We have no more choices, and if we leave it up to this administration, they will take us into a single-payer healthcare system. Now, what we know, pre-existing conditions are important, right? There's a lot of us with them, and we have to make sure we protect that. We have to make sure we protect our veterans and our veteran services. And right now, that's not happening. We need to close the urban rural divide with telemedicine. We need to make sure that we have enough healthcare in the workforce. Right now, they're asking our healthcare workforce to, we're firing them from their jobs because they wouldn't be take the vaccine. Is that where we're headed again? Medicare Advantage has been a benefit for a lot of people. We need to make sure that we're more patient-centric. We need to make sure that we have more choices. We need to go against state lines and be able to choose. If we don't get back to patient-centric and being able to have more than one choice, there will be not enough money for our seniors or our future children. So I'm telling you, we cannot go to the single-payer healthcare system, and we need to fight. And right now, this administration, if we don't elect new congressional leaders, that's where we're headed. And do we want to be like every other foreign nation? I don't believe so.
Thank you, Lori. I'd like to shift to immigration policy. What sort of reforms would you like to see Congress enact in terms of immigration policy?
That's for me first, correct?
Yes.
Yes, thank you. So what are we seeing across the nation today? More than 2 million illegal immigrants have come across in this last year. We need to close our southern border for several reasons. One, we don't know who's crossing the border. We know that they're exploiting asylum seekers. There are parents and their children who are looking for asylum. That's a different category than what we're seeing today with single men who are taking children from their families. The coyotes are exploiting thousands and thousands of dollars from these families across the southern border. They're raping them, they're killing them, and they're using them. Why? Because they don't care about those people. They are drug cartels, they are the coyotes, and nobody cares about them. We need to close that southern border. We need to make sure we know who's coming forward. Why? Because the drugs are coming in and they're killing our kids. Over 100,000 deaths in America. That's not okay with me. I don't know why that would be okay with you. Not only do we need to build the wall, we need to make sure that we're funding our Border Patrol completely. You can see it every single day on the news. They're leaving the industry. They don't have the support because they don't have the change in leadership. We need to make sure that we stop unaccompanied minors and make sure we know who's bringing them across. We have an E-Verify for workers. We can do the same. We work with our agencies in Congress to make sure that we can check and see who's coming over the border. What is wrong with a little more, when we get our driver's license, right? They want to know who we are. When we ask people who come to work for us, we have to have them verify who they are. I'm telling you, we have lost our way in this country by allowing illegal immigrants. My family came over from Mexico. A lot of us are immigrants in this country. We need them in our country. You need to come over legally.
Illegal immigration is clearly an issue. We have had more illegal immigrants than we've had since 1987. That's 35 years, and we set the record last year. And there's pressure on both sides of the border. When the Biden administration runs the economy so hot and gives away so much money, there's an incredible amount of jobs available. And then you combine that with the fact that López Obrador, AMLO, the president of Mexico, is anti-capitalist. He's literally a socialist. This man has praised Cuba. The first thing he did when he got into office is he canceled a multi-billion dollar project building a new airport in Mexico City. What did that do? That sent word to all the businesses in Mexico to stop investing. So that has pushed a lot of Mexicans north. Now, clearly we need to build a wall, and we need to fund our border patrol at a much greater rate than we already are. But it's not just Mexico. If you look at what's happening in Brazil, Bolsonaro, unfortunately, 14% interest rates. I've heard numbers of over 400,000 Haitians that were living in Brazil have now come to America. It's happening in Venezuela. Maduro, Chavez, the way they have ruined Venezuela. That was the number one economy in South America in the 90s. Now it is the worst economy in South America. There have been millions of Venezuelans that have been trying to get to America. This problem is going to get worse. If you look at what's happened in Chile, they have just elected a socialist president for the first time. Argentina has a socialist president. Unfortunately, there's a socialist wave that's happening all across the southern border, and this problem is going to get much worse before it gets better.
Thank you. A socialist wave in Latin America, but not a socialist wave in these United States, if we work hard this year. I'm sorry, I had to say that. Next question is actually a question as to federalism. The role of the federal government in controlling so much property in the state of Oregon, the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, what do you see in terms of what you can do in Congress in terms of federal control and regulation of so much of our land here in Oregon? And Lori, you get to go first on this one. Did I get that right? No, you were second, so now you get to go first. Jimmy gets it first.
Well, so this is the biggest issue I think we're facing on a congressional level. It's sad that unfortunately 53% of the state of Oregon is managed by the federal government. That's over 32 million acres. Both my grandfathers worked in the timber business. My dad's first job was in the woods. We had 85,000 timber workers when I was a kid. That number is now down to 25,000. We have lost 60,000 blue collar working wage jobs in Oregon, and they have not been replaced. If you look at a county like Crook County, they used to have 5 mills. I was told the GDP of Crook County in the 70s was higher than Washington County. And this policy is insane. Basically, they have shut down the federally managed lands. We used to get 50% of our timber from them. We used to have produced 5 billion board feet in the state of Oregon. That number is 2.5 billion board feet right now. We are literally killing rural Oregon with these policies. And the federal government takes no responsibility. 95% of the roads on the federally managed lands have fallen into disrepair. Why? Because we're not in the federally managed lands. What does that hurt? That hurts timber, that hurts fighting fires. And unfortunately, now that we get less than 10% of our timber from those federally managed lands, it's gone into disrepair. And so what you've seen over the last 30 years is incredible amounts of forest fires. We are losing literally 1 million acres a year. So people want to talk about climate change, and I say, wait a second. The forest fire in Southern Oregon was 400,000 acres this last summer. That was the responsibility of the federal government, because they don't allow us to manage our own land. And that those forest fires cause incredible damage to our seniors, to our pregnant women, and in fact, it's about the equivalent of 3 years of driving on all the Oregon roads, the pollution that comes out of those forest fires. The federal government needs to take responsibility for this land.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So I think it's a little bit bigger than that, because when we're talking about federalism, or you know, the federal government taking over for our natural resources here in timber, I mean, really, that's what we're known for in this country. I mean, in this state, right? All the trees, and we see it. And we talk about, what did it fund? All the timber towns were decimated. Jobs were lost. Rural school funding was lost. And so we ask ourselves, we'd like to bring it back to the state of Oregon, because we can do better. And when we're talking about states' rights, that's important. But here's the question. The National Environmental Protection Agency didn't do us any favors after the 70s, right? I mean, what we thought was that we're gonna, you know, Smokey the Bear, right? That's what we're thinking about. We like to protect our natural forests, but if we bring it back to states' rights, are we gonna do any better with Kate Brown? Are we gonna do any better with the leaders that we have in this state? You think they're gonna give us back those state lands? They're gonna do the exact same thing. We have to change our leadership here. And we have to remember that we can fight this if we elect new leaders. You know, the wildfires came from Clackamas County, they were in Central Oregon, they were in Southern Oregon. And everybody thought, my goodness, the let it burn policies that we have in place are no better at the federal government than right now that they are at the state government. So when we say we want to bring the federal lands into state authority, we have to be careful. We need to elect our local leaders here in this state if we want to manage those better and return those federal lands to the people. That's what we want, but we want to make sure we manage them, because they are our natural resource and we have to count on them for the rest. I mean, Oregon is the most beautiful state we've ever lived in, and we have to remember, be careful what we ask for until we change leadership here in Oregon.
Now we're going to shift to public safety and crime and the role of the federal government. You can touch on gun rights if you wish, because Democrats talk about that all the time in a negative way. And what is your perspective about what Congress should be doing about public safety across the country?
Well, public safety is important to me. As a mayor, I made sure that we fully funded our police force always. One of the things that citizens always ask for is they want to feel safe in their communities, right? When they wake up in the morning, they lock their door and they put their kids on the bus, they want to make sure their homes are safe and their kids are safe and their families are safe. They want to be able to go to work, come home, and make sure when they lock their doors or don't lock their doors, that they should be protected. And when something goes wrong, and what are we seeing now? High criminal activity in every area outside of Portland, Central Oregon, Oregon's 5th District. It's important to support our police, fund our police. On a federal level, I will tell you, one of the things we haven't done is talk about the Department of Justice and talk about the U.S. attorneys. As congressional leaders, what I have done as mayor is make sure that we can put the pressure on the DOJ and the U.S. attorneys to prosecute the crimes. We are seeing them walk into the courtroom, and these attorneys let them walk right out the back door. And we, as congressional leaders, need to make sure that we support those leaders here in Oregon, and we have to put the pressure on those U.S. attorneys. As far as gun rights go, we're going to hear this as our backdrop and as our narrative, that this is a gun problem. We're going to hear it in this election. It is not a gun problem, but law-abiding citizens do not kill people. Criminals kill people. Criminals use those guns, and they don't follow the rules. I don't care how many gun laws you put in place, We have some of the strictest gun laws in Oregon with background checks. I just went for two guns the other day, and it took. I have a concealed carry for years, and I still had to wait a couple of weeks to get my guns. We have plenty of security checks in place. The criminals don't follow those. We need to crack down on those gun crimes. We need to make sure that they are federally prosecuted in this state, and that's what we can do as congressional leaders.
Yeah, I would agree with Lori on that. You know, there's, unfortunately, the left always blames the guns, and that is simply not the case. And I don't think that gun laws have changed in Portland over the last couple of years, yet the murder rate is up 300% from pre-pandemic levels. The murder rate in Portland is now at an all-time high, and it beat the record set during the crack epidemic of 1987 by 25%. The reason? This whole notion of defunding the police. And more than defunding the police, it's ruining the morale of the police. And what you can do as a leader is you can say, I'm with you. I stick with the police. That is critical. The police bureau needs to hear that. They need to have confidence from their elected leaders. Unfortunately, in Portland, they've lost over 150 police officers, either quit or retired early. They tried to hire back 82 of those police officers. Only two of them responded out of 82. This is a major issue. When you start losing a city like we're losing Portland, it is very hard to turn it around. You are seeing businesses just abandon Portland. It is so sad to walk around. It looks like Beirut. You know, you have boarded up buildings. Unfortunately, the police are overwhelmed. Friends of mine had their building broken into and all the computers were stolen. They showed up 15 minutes after the alarm went off. The police showed up 4 hours later, and they said, we simply don't have the resources. We just, unless there's an active shooter. So it's a tragedy what's happened, and unfortunately, we're seeing it spread. So as a political leader, what you can do is you can say, I have your back to the police force. That is critical. Thank you.
Thank you, Jimmy. I'd like to mention that a third candidate was invited to be with us tonight, John DiPaolo. But he is ill and contacted us this morning to apologize that he's not able to join us tonight. Just so you know that he wasn't giving you the back of his hand, he just could not be with you tonight, just so you know that. He withdrew from the race? Well, I didn't even get that part of it. John DiPaolo withdrew from the race this morning. All right.
It's verified.
All right. Well, we have the two candidates here tonight. I'll leave it at that. I just wanted to mention why I had understood that he wasn't here tonight. So let's move on to another topic, which really touches on the federal government versus the state government, but something that's very, very concerning to rural Oregon, which is water rights, the use of water. And on this one, Jimmy, you get to go first and tell us, what is your perception as to what Congress ought to be doing in regard to our dams, our rivers, our streams, and the federal government role as to controlling water in our communities?
Well, I guess the old saying is whiskey is for drinking and water's for fighting, right? So I think that is a notion that we've had on the West Coast for a long time. Unfortunately, I think we need local control. The federal government really needs to control or give back local control of the water rights. We have plenty of water in Oregon, and at the end of the day, it's more of an energy issue, right? We're allowing 5 trillion gallons to go out the Columbia River into the Pacific every year. To me, that seems like an easy solution for our farmers. The federal government, unfortunately, seems to always get in the way. What we've seen down in southern Oregon, on the border of California, the removal of dams, is really sad. Unfortunately, we're prioritizing frogs and fish over farmers. And to me, that is, it's unconscious. It's unconscionable. You know, you just cannot allow that to happen. You would have thought we learned our lesson in Oregon with the spotted owl, but unfortunately, you know, they keep coming up with different animals to go after us with. And to me, it's just bananas. You know, at the end of the day, the best thing the federal government can do would be to cut the lawyers off at the knees. I apologize if there are any lawyers here, but the fact that we are paying the lawyers' fees to sue the government to protect, you know, this spotted frog, I don't get that. I mean, that is bananas. But, you know, unfortunately, the federal government, the people in Washington, they don't seem to have a water problem. They don't seem to get it. And when your federal delegation only has one Republican fighting, that's really sad. And this is the year we're going to get more than one Republican.
Yeah.
Lauren, take it away.
Protecting our farmers and ranchers is important, right? They feed this nation. And when we pit them one against the other because of the environmentalists who would rather not feed the nation, it's a problem. We're fighting over water. The irrigation system's in place. Look at Central Oregon. There's 5 irrigation districts who are all fighting junior water rights, senior water rights, piping, building, spending millions and millions of dollars. And now what are they doing? They're taking their land out of production. They're selling their water rights to their neighbors who are corporatizing and monetizing the few 1 to 5 acres that were left to feed not only Central Oregon, but other parts of this country. The environmentalists have decided they're gonna make the laws. It is our current congressional delegation who is on the dole and decided that they're more powerful than the leaders that we have in office. Cliff Bentz can't do this alone. I'm supported by Cliff Bentz because he understands those water rights as a rancher in Central Oregon. He understands in Eastern Oregon, and he's decided he needs an ally. And I'm telling you, I grew up in Central California where we did exactly the same thing, and they're fighting because this is where they can conquer and divide. We cannot continue to have this handled in court because we're losing millions of dollars in police, or people are closing up shop, and we're seeing fifth generation Oregonians decide to pack up and move out. These are our families. We have to stick next to them, and we have to fight for them. We always have to be on the side of our ranchers and our farmers, because if we don't have water, we cannot grow the food, and we cannot sell it. And it is one of our most prized commodities here in Oregon, and we have to make sure that we're always on their side.
The next question has to do with COVID, the response, the stimulus spending, the national policy in response to the international pandemic, and how you as a member of Congress would respond to them.
I think the biggest response with COVID is that it exposed the abuse of power. And we saw it so clearly here in Oregon. We were one of the last states to have the masks taken away. We were one of the last states to open up businesses to fully get back to normal. You know, our small businesses, I was proud to open a lot of small businesses in Happy Valley and do lots of ribbon cuttings. That's important for people. They spend their hard working dollars, their retirements, to do so. For the government to continue to mandate them out of business, that's not socialism, it's communism. It's a taking of their businesses, and we have to stop that. We are, again, are in the healthcare industry. When we saw our healthcare workers come to us for exemptions or be fired, we gave them those exemptions. We have over 150 employees serving in our GI clinics, in our surgery centers, in our hospitals, and we had to say to them, you have two choices. We'll give you the exemption. We want to keep you working here. Some of our businesses survived and some didn't. And what did we hear from our government here in Oregon and the federal government? Was, that's okay, there'll be more businesses that open in the future. Do you know what that does? It breaks the backs of the small business owners in America. We cannot continue to count on our corporations to fund this country, this small business that has built this country. And if we don't stick by them in times like this, we're gonna lose our country. Yeah. Lockdowns don't work. The overspending of stimulus dollars, people took that money and they bought cars and they went on vacation. Some of us used it to survive. But the fraudulent behavior, $24 million, $2 million was recovered in Oregon. Look at the fraudulent behavior on the federal level. And our current administration says, we're not gonna go after that money. We don't need that money back. They wanna give us more dollars. They're looking to give another COVID relief. We need to change our leadership. We have to stop spending.
Thank you.
Well, I would say that The Trump administration did a phenomenal job in getting money out to businesses. That was critical. When the economy was shut down, the $5 trillion that was passed and given out to businesses was critical. We needed to do that. What we did not need to do was shut down. And the great thing about the United States is you have 50 different experiments on how to handle COVID. I look at a state like Nebraska that never shut down. The governor recommended that maybe you shut down, but didn't say you had to. And then from there, if you look at the outcomes, their health outcomes weren't worse. In fact, their education outcomes outpaced Oregon's. It almost was double. And unfortunately, we're gonna see the impact of this for years on our children. You know, those lost years in the classroom, you can't get them back. That's why elections matter. Because Kate Brown's handling of COVID versus states like Florida and Nebraska and the Dakotas, there's a stark contrast. And we need to point that out as Republicans. We need to be proud of trusting citizens with their own rights and not having mandates coming down from the overlords. The other thing that the federal government should be demanding is accountability from China. Let's not kid ourselves, right? I mean, the Chinese government hid this virus. They need to be held accountable by the federal government. It is outrageous, their behavior. Thank God we don't live in Shanghai right now. Thank you. Thank you.
Jimmy, we're going to shift again to another topic, election integrity. There's a lot of discussion of that, a lot of concern about that. The question is, what role does the federal government play in controlling what states do in terms of their elections and the efforts by the mainly Democrats in Congress to control state elections?
So we're not talking about the Dorchester straw poll election Well, you know, I got suspicious when I got invited to this debate by someone who had endorsed Lori. So I was like, this I feel like the books are cooked already. So, this is, this is an issue that is really critical because we need Republicans to trust elections. And unfortunately, right now, our confidence has been shaken. When you have a state like Pennsylvania that doesn't go through procedures and just changes election laws, that's wrong and needs to be corrected. Now, I don't want the federal government involved in elections. I think that we're best handling it on a local level, but I'll tell you, in Oregon right now, this system of vote by mail does not work. And you know, for me personally, the first time I learned about politics was going to my elementary school with my dad, walked into the voting booth, and he explained to me, this is why you vote as a Republican. You know, I was trying to think, well, what year would that have been? 1988, George H.W. Bush. Boy, that was a long time ago. So yeah, I look at election integrity and I think that this is critical because we need to give confidence back to the Republicans. And whatever that takes, if that's an audit, then do audits. If that's getting polling stations back open in Oregon, we need to do that. That's why the governor's race is so important. That's why the state legislature races are so important, because we need control back in order to change laws. Because the current system is not working for Republicans. I think everyone can see the evidence in that.
Thank you.
The books are cooked. I've just invested 22 years in this district, and I know a lot of people. According to the Heritage Foundation, do you know Oregon ranks 48th in election integrity based on how we do elections here? Right? Let me think about that. Vote by mail. They put the stamp on it. They ballot harvest. You don't have to show ID. You don't have to prove who you are, except now through a computer. I can go to your house and ask you for your ballot, have you sign it and turn it in for you. And I can turn it in late and I can get a fine and it'll still count. It's ridiculous. We've seen the cheating. We know what happens. And any time that if the people feel disenfranchised, that's what we need to focus on. We need to go back to in-person voting in Oregon, or at least have a voice. We don't need our federal government meddling in our elections here in Oregon. We just need to make sure that we have the leaders in place who believe in integrity. So when we ask, is mail-in voting work? It works for honest people, but it sure opens the door for a lot of fraudulent behavior. And that's what we're seeing. If we can go back to checking IDs, making sure one vote, one person, you have to be alive and you have to show a picture ID, what is wrong with that? We can get that in our rural Oregon. We can put that out there for people. Our Secretary of State does none of that. She doesn't care about that now. Dennis Richardson, he cared about that. He cared about audits. He cared about holding people accountable. We don't need the federal government in our elections. We need to make sure we can go back and have a choice in in-person voting. We need to prove who we are, because that's what democracy is about. That's what people expect, that their vote will always count, and we need to make sure we bring that back and hold the federal government accountable now and stop the cheating that's been happening.
We're going to shift to a fairly specific topic, which is tolls. Road tolls and what the federal government may or may not require in terms of road tolls in order to construct additional highways. What is your position? Laura, you go first.
No, I'm tolling.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah.
And this has come up because in Clackamas County, we're seeing that, right? We're seeing that at the commission level. We're seeing that across Oregon in order to avoid congestion or relieve congestion. And what we know, studies show, it doesn't relieve any congestion. What it does is pushes that traffic out into the suburbs and into the areas that are around the tolling, right? Around the freeways. It doesn't do any good. It costs more monies for those small communities. You know, Oregon has 240 very small communities. They can't afford to deal with that congestion. The tolling is not gonna make any change in congestion. And I'll tell you, people are tired. People are tired of paying it over and over again and not seeing it really invested in the infrastructure. The infrastructure package that was passed by the federal government that they were touting yesterday at the airport, I'm going to tell you, as a mayor, regional flexible funds come from the federal government. They pass through the state and go on to the metro and the county level. I lobbied for $2.4 million in 2015 for a safe routes to schools. We got that money in 2015. Do you know that project was just finished this year at the tune of almost double what we received? Because you're gonna get pennies on the dollar. And in this inflationary time, it is not a time to pass an infrastructure package that is gonna cost millions of dollars. And that includes tolling. If the county commission thinks about tolling in Clackamas County, you're gonna have a mistake on your hands, and elections will matter at this point.
Yeah, tolling, unfortunately, is not good. And I'll tell you why. When I lived in New York City, the tolls, you had to pay a toll to get almost anywhere. Now, these were all federal roads, right? And they promised that the tolls would only be around for, you know, a year or two or 5 years. We're talking 100 years later on some of these bridges, like the Triborough Bridge. It used to be 25 cents. When I first moved to New York 20 years ago, it was, you know, $1.50. Now it's $14. Once the federal government gets their hands on something like that, watch out. And I don't trust that they're gonna do the right thing. And I'm very worried, right? When you have four Democrats, two Democratic senators, do they have our best interests at hand? I mean, the reality is, you know, Ron Wyden lives in Manhattan, so he doesn't care about Oregon tolling. You know, Kurt Schrader lives in the Hamptons. I mean, come on. But what it does is it affects businesses, right? Because if you used to go somewhere to shop and then all of a sudden the toll is in the way, you no longer use that business, you go the opposite direction. That has economic impacts on the localities that are around the tolls because people don't want to spend extra money. And people have options. You can go on other roads. You can go to other supermarkets. It is very dangerous, this tolling notion. And I am against it 100%.
So maybe start with you again on this one. This has to do with international affairs and the tragedy, the criminality that confronts us with what Russia is doing to Ukraine, and what role the United States and Congress might play in resisting Russian aggression, whether or not, how heavily should we be involved, how much should Congress be pressing this president to be involved in the defense of Ukraine and dealing with Russian aggression?
Yeah, the Russian aggression is very concerning. We've seen this over and over from Putin, and generally it's whenever oil prices are above $100. If you remember in 2008, he went into Georgia, he took two regions, he took South Ossetia and another one because oil was $150 a barrel. Back in 2014, with oil at $120 a barrel, he went into Crimea. Again, with oil at almost $100 a barrel, he goes into Ukraine. Why? He has $65 billion in reserves. It is very hard to take him on. I caution the United States on taking him on, but what we do need to do is pressure people that are supporting him. The country of India is staying neutral. There are other 50 other countries that are staying neutral. I understand why India is doing it. The Modi government gets 70% of their defense spending goes towards Russia. They're worried if they go against the Russians that their defense is going to be cut off. I understand that. But the reality is 30% of the world's wheat comes out of Ukraine and Russia. We are going to have riots across Middle East and South Asia. You're already seeing it in Pakistan. The Premier Khan was already removed from office. Sisi in Egypt is going to be dealing with a major issue. This is going to cause Erdogan in Turkey a major problem as well. Without that wheat source coming out of Ukraine and Russia, we are going to have major issues coming from a multitude of countries. It happened last time we had a wheat crisis about 12 years ago. We had 45 different countries that went up in flames. This is a major concern. And the biggest issue for me when it concerns the United States is that President Xi in China right now is watching the world's reaction to Russia. And President Xi wants Taiwan and he'll do anything to take it. And unfortunately, the United States has allowed 85% of our semiconductors to be manufactured in Taiwan. That is an Achilles heel for the world economy, and we need to get those semiconductors back. Unfortunately, our politicians in Oregon, when Intel wanted 2,000 acres, only gave them 200. So what did they do? They moved to Ohio. They're spending $20 to $30 billion in Ohio, not here in Oregon. I am very worried about the Chinese taking Taiwan. That is going to be a major concern over the next 10 years.
Thank you.
And so why does history repeat itself? Poor leadership. If Donald Trump had still been president, the Russians wouldn't be in Ukraine. What we're seeing today is tragic. We have a lot of Ukrainian families that live here in Oregon who are worried about their families. It's very, very sad what we see on TV. But why are the Ukrainians still fighting? Because they're resilient, right? What we thought 1 week has now been 2 months. But we have to make sure that we are not energy dependent on those foreign countries, and it all comes down to that energy. When we talk about Taiwan, the difference in Taiwan from Ukraine is that Ukraine was not in NATO. And it took us a while to figure out, what are we gonna do? Are we gonna send over any help? We don't want boots on the ground. Have Americans asked themselves if they can stomach another ground war? The leadership, think about pulling out of Afghanistan. 13 service members died. We're seeing more deaths than we've ever seen. But Taiwan, we have an agreement with, and we have to make sure we get ahead of this game, because they see the weak leadership and they're gonna take action. We have to become energy independent. I'm sure we're gonna see it with Kim Jong-un, North Korea to South Korea as well. They're watching America. We have to make sure that we are the powerhouse in this country, and we have to change leadership again. And I might be repeating myself over and over again, but elections matter, and we've gotten ourselves in this position where we are now dependent on every other country but ourselves. We can be energy independent. We can have our own resources here in America, but we have to believe in America, and we have to decide. We invest now, get back to that powerhouse, and everybody will settle down.
Thank you. We'll have time for one more question, and then each candidate will be allowed to make a two-minute closing statement. This is a free play question. I'd like you to pause for a moment and think of the one topic you would like to address for a couple of minutes that I've not brought up, other than what you want to say in your closing. So you'll at least get 2 minutes to talk about one or two topics that Kevin skipped over. And Lori, you get to go first.
want to talk about education. We didn't really touch on education and a parent's bill of rights. Now, I raised two girls through the education system here in Oregon, and we're seeing that be affected every single day. COVID really did peel back the layers, didn't it? And I'm going to tell, as parents, we were a little bit asleep at the wheel. We trusted our teachers. We trusted our school districts to take our kids and protect them and teach them reading, writing, and math. And now what are they being taught? How to hate each other, how to divide each other, racism, critical race theory, sexual orientation as early as first and second grade. You know, somebody like Governor Ron DeSantis, who stood up and said, enough is enough. It is our job and our right as parents to tell our kids and to teach our kids. And we need to get the political ideology out of the classroom. It's a political agenda to divide this nation. Parents have a right to be in the classroom. And a parent's bill of rights is something that I would like to focus on when I'm in Washington, D.C. as your next congresswoman, because it's time for parents to stand up. If you can't afford to put your kids in private school, you should have been able to trust your public school that you pay thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, your tax dollars, for them to be educated in this country. We need to make sure that the money follows the child and that you should be able to put your kids wherever you want that fits their needs. That is something that we're missing, and it's something that we need to stay focused on.
Thank you.
I'd like to discuss inflation because I think it is the number one priority for Americans right now. We are, unfortunately, the average family of four is spending between $300 and $500 per month more than they were a year ago on food and energy prices. To fill up my truck this morning, it was $120. I mean, that's double what it was a year ago. The federal government is directly responsible for this. The $1.9 trillion bill that was passed last year has caused dramatic inflation. Inflation of 8.5% is the largest rate we've had since 1981. If you strip out food and energy, U.S.'s inflation is 6%. If you do the same in Europe, it's 3%. That means that we are directly responsible. The federal government is directly responsible for the inflation that's happening in the United States. If you looked at the throughput in the ports, last year it was up 16% year over year in the United States. Why? Because we are showering people with money. And then all these goods came in through the ports. The difference in the European Union, year over year, was 1%. Think about the difference. 16% in the US, 1% in Europe. The federal government has gotten out of control in its spending, and it is hurting everybody's bottom line. Now, they'll argue, hey, labor, you know, is getting paid 6% year over year, but that is still a 2% tax on everyone. And that's the direct responsibility of the federal government, and in Congress, we need to get the spending under control. It is really sad, and I'm really worried, because economics basically state when inflation is over 4% and unemployment is under 4%, we go into a recession every time. I'm very worried about the next year or two. And I'm really worried if we don't course correct.
All right, it's time to wrap this up.
All right.
That's all right, because we're doing closing now, and you get 2 minutes each to do closing. So we'll follow up now with having a chance to do closing for 2 minutes.
Great, thank you very much. I appreciate everyone for coming. It's really meaningful. We've seen across the district, Republicans are excited, and that's a good thing. I know in Deschutes County, we have the most PCPs we've ever had. The excitement is there. The ability to win this race is there. The National Party has circled the 5th Congressional District for a reason. Because they believe that we can win this. And having a district that touches Portland be Republican is huge. And I believe that I'm the candidate that can beat Kurt Schrader in November. I've been very fortunate. My fundraising has been incredible. We've outraised all the other candidates combined. I've gotten endorsements from the Oregonian, from the Oregon Firearms Federation, and from Oregon right to life, which is really critical for me. And unfortunately, our two campaigns have had a disagreement over this, because in 2018, when Lori ran for state legislature, she ran as a pro-choice candidate. And to me, that's an issue that is non-negotiable. She'll tell you now that she's pro-life, but I think as Republicans, we need to stick to our guns, and I worry what other policies will change. I realize it was a state rep race and this is a federal race, but as Republicans, we need to stick with our policies, because our policies will work. This is the year we're gonna win if we choose the right candidates. I'm incredibly proud of the organization we put together. My campaign manager spent 3.5 years working for the Trump administration. We have a serious campaign, and I would appreciate your support, and I want to thank you all for coming tonight.
Lori, your closing statement.
We can be as sad and worried and sad and worried and sad and worried as we want. But if we don't have somebody elected to this office who has a proven track record of building a business from 5 to 150, know what it's like to sign the front of a check and the back of a check, if we don't have somebody who's a parent in the education system who's brought their kids up to know what we're fighting for, if we don't know what it's like to be a mayor and watch small businesses suffer unless we are their allies and not their adversaries, if we don't elect somebody to Congress who's not gonna be one and done, because we need to hold this office. I've worked hard for 22 years in Oregon's 5th District to invest my time to get to know all of you and build those relationships that will take me to Washington, D.C. Being a box checker doesn't always work. I am for life. I am a mom, and I've carried life inside of me. And everybody knows what a miracle that is. I am anti-abortion, except for rape, incest, and the life of a mother. And if that puts me in that category, then that's what he chooses to say. But I've been endorsed by Right to Life legislators. I've been endorsed by Right to Life people because they know my heart, and I'm not gonna stand here and listen to that. In Congress, I will always be on the side of life, because we know that the extreme left wants abortion on demand, and they want it funded. I am not for taxpayer-funded abortion, and never will be. I will fight because I'm on your team, and nobody's gonna question how much I love life and how important that is to me. I don't care who you are. Now, I've been endorsed by Elise Stefanik, the third-ranking member of the U.S. House. I've been endorsed by VUPAC. I've been endorsed by Maggie's List. I've been endorsed by legislators. I'm supported by Cliff Bentz, Mike McClain, and mayors and city councilors throughout. And I appreciate you all being here tonight. It means a lot to me. I will be your next Congresswoman, and I'm the only one who can win the general election once I win this primary. Thank you guys for being here tonight.
Wow, what a debate. You know, listening to the recording, I could almost close my eyes and just, you know, picture the room layout, and where exactly I was in the room during the debate. It was an amazing experience that I won't soon forget, and I hope to do it next year. I would like to tell all of you listening that I am not going to tell you who you should and shouldn't be voting for during this primary. As a medium personality, as small as I may be, I believe that it is my, at least some part of my responsibility, to bring you the issues and the candidates, rather than giving you who I believe would be best suited for representing the 5th Congressional District. Now, that won't happen until we get once we go past the 17th, then we'll talk about my issues and all that. But for right now, it's about you getting the information and unbiased, unfiltered information from the candidates themselves. With that being said, I would like to say that you will be hearing 3 debates, as I said, from Dorchester. obviously the 5th Congressional District. Then you will have the 6th Congressional District, which is a relatively new district drawn through redistricting here in Oregon. And a surprise debate, you will be getting the 6th Congressional District on Wednesday. And on Friday, we have a very special debate that I will not be saying anything about until that day. But trust me, it is well, well worth it. I would also like to say that all these candidates who have taken the stage at Dorchester for debates, I would like to get on the show. So you can, I like to get on the show before the 17th, for the primary, so that way you can hear them, you can hear their policies and procedures and their ideas and their ideology to make a more informed decision about who you would like to put up against Kurt Schrader in November. That is for District 5, for District 6, and for the very special debate. We're talking about representation of the common Oregonian. But we'll get into that as it gets more complicated for Friday's debate. I would like to say thank you for taking time out of your busy day to spend some time with me here at the Oregon Conservative. I'd also like to add that our moderator, the Honorable Kevin Mannix, is also running for Oregon House District 21. House District 21 is a relatively new district, which used to be just North Salem, but now because of redistricting, it now includes Kaiser. So 21 and 25 kind of merge together as far as Salem and Kaiser. Now, the new district incorporates North Salem and Kaiser. And I hope to have Kevin on the show so you can hear, for my friends in the Salem-Kaiser area, to hear more about his policies and what he would like to do and why he believes he is the best Republican on the ticket to best represent the Salem-Kaiser area. Now, we're just going to focus on the primary. We'll be also focusing for the general election, but that time will come. I'd like to thank all of you again for listening to the show. If you enjoy the show and you enjoy the things that I do here, why not consider following the podcast and leaving a 5-star review? If you really enjoy the content and you enjoy the things that I do, go ahead and head to my website and you can go ahead and donate to the show. It is through your continued support that I can continue to do this free of charge. And I'd also like to say, maybe you don't want to support the podcast monetarily, which is fine. I'm not forcing you. But head to my website and sign up for my newsletter. In the newsletter, we'll be having more in-depth conversations about topics that I will be getting into throughout the month of the show. And we'll also be getting into some things different that I did not talk about on the show. Rejected topics for the show that we will go into the newsletter. I'll also tell you about things that are going to come out. I will give you kind of a schedule of what the month will look like. And you guys can get to interact with me. I will take your questions through email. So make sure you sign up for my newsletter. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening. I am the Oregon Conservative, and remember, no matter how bleak it seems now, we will retake the state of Oregon. Thank you very much, and I will see you next Tuesday.